Hey y'all, it's Dr. Samina Rahman, Gyno Girl. I'm a board-certified gynecologist, a clinical assistant professor of OBGYN at Northwestern Feinberg School of Medicine, and owner of a private practice for almost a decade that specializes in menopause and sexual medicine. I'm a South Asian American Muslim woman who is here to empower, educate, and help you advocate for health issues that have been stigmatized, shamed, and perhaps even prevented you from living your best life. I'm better than your best girlfriend and more open than most of your doctors. I'm here to educate so you can advocate. Welcome to Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. Let's go. Hey y'all, it's me, Dr. Samina Rahman, Gyno Girl. Welcome to another episode of Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. I am Dr. Samina Rahman, and I'm here to introduce a friend of mine podcast. Before I do, let me remind you who I am. I am a board-certified gynecologist in downtown Chicago. I am a sexual medicine and menopause specialist, and basically am a private practice doc who is now turning her practice into concierge medicine with Ms. Medicine, a nationally recognized concierge group of physicians. And so I'm super excited about that. That's coming next month. And I'm also happy to announce that my book will be coming out hopefully in the next 6 months, Brown Girls Disease? A Guide to Sexual Health and Empowerment Through a South Asian Lens. So stay tuned. I'm doing a lot. But I just finished an interview with a close colleague, friend, and my own beloved urologist. So we're going to talk about that. But her name is Dr. Fenwa Milhouse. She's board certified and fellowship trained in urologist and a specialist in female pelvic medicine and reconstructive surgery. She was originally born in Nigeria. Her family immigrated to the U.S. when she was a young child. She grew up in Texas, ended up at the University of Texas at Houston for med school. And it was there she discovered urology for the first time. She's going to talk about that. She talked about that on my platform. She trained at the University of Chicago for urology residency and completed her pelvic medicine and reconstructive surgery fellowship as well. She's a distinguished recipient of the 2023 Healthcare Impact Award and also named a top urologist in Chicago. Her office is not that far from mine. She works in Chicago. She's a mother and a wife. She's a mother of three. She is passionate about introducing the public to the world of urology, and she has her own private practice. She's amazing. You should follow her. She is funny and amazing and down to earth. So let's get at it. Hey, y'all, it's me, Dr. Samina Rahman, Gyno Girl. Welcome back to another episode of Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. I'm Dr. Samina Rahman, and as you heard on my intro, I have a very special guest today, good friend, colleague, and my own favorite urologist, Dr. Fenwa Milhouse. Welcome to Sex, Drugs, and Hormones.
Thank you. I love the title of your podcast. I really
do. Oh, thank you. SDH, Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. We love it.
I love it. I love it. Thank you for having me.
Of course.
And I'm pleased to be your favorite urologist, and yes.
Considering my older brothers are urologists.
Yeah. I don't know how it feels about that. Yep.
Anyway, so how's it going? I'm so happy to have you here. You're such a fun person to be around, and you are like literally my urologist, so which we could talk about. But I figured you could tell me a little bit about your journey into the field of really female urology. I know you see both, but really you're focused, you've honed in on female urology, and you're down the street from me. So we actually do get to see each other every so often. But, and then I just want to talk about some of the issues that plague so many of the patients that we see around quality of life with regard to urinary incontinence and prolapse and all that stuff. So,
yeah. So I'm a board certified urologist. I'm also fellowship trained in female pelvic medicine and reconstructive surgery, which is basically like female urology. Mm-hmm. I own my own practice, just around down the street, so to speak, from Dr. Rahman, who I have to give you your flowers. You were a big inspiration and really a big sister type cheerleader when I did this whole owning my own practice thing. And, you know, when I went to you, I thought, you know, she could easily be like, you got to figure out your own. Like, I figured out my own, you know, and because some of the stuff we do overlaps, could easily have kind of said, well, I don't want to help my quote unquote competition, but you were not like that at all. Yeah. You were such a girl's girl, which I love because I'm a girl's girl too. And were like, oh, let me help you. Yeah, no one helped me, but I'm just going to tell you, like, this is what you should do. Yeah. And, you know, kind of giving me your own tips and kind of what you did to get your foot in the door. So I do appreciate that very much. And I'll always cherish you for that.
Like I always say, like, there's millions of vulvas in Chicago and we need a very few number to keep us, we need a few number to keep our doors open. So
yeah. And like literally we see some patients, so we share like a handful of patients that see both you and me and like, sure, see both of us.
Oh yeah. No, sure. No, I agree. I was like, well, Dr. Milhouse said this and I'm like, yeah, she's right. Yeah. You should try.
And I'm like, whatever she said, when they say, oh, I've seen Dr. Mon, I'm like, you're in the right place. Like whatever she says.
No, you should do that. That's absolutely right. What you should do.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's nice. So, I like that we can collaborate like that.
So anyway, how I got into this field, I did not think I was going to be a urologist. When I first learned about it in medical school, I thought that is for men, by men. Mm-hmm. I saw pictures of urologists and like the urologists that I knew of, which was very few. They were men, old men,
right?
Mostly white men. And I thought, I'm a black woman, like there's nothing for me. And they treat prostates and penis problems and, you know, whatnot.
Yeah.
And then I met a black woman urologist who gave us a lecture in our second year of medical school. And I was blown away and really took a liking to her because here she was this representation that looked like me in this field that was very much did not have a lot of diversity. And so I saw myself for the first time as a urologist in her, and I thought she was super, super dope. And I just wanted to be like her. And so I shadowed her and a bunch of other urologists, and they just seemed to really like what they do.
Yes.
And they seemed really relaxed.
They're fun. And urologists relatable, are
fun. Like just good vibes. And it seems really like shallow to say, but I chose urology off of good vibes.
And I chose gynecology in spite of the bad vibes that I used to get. These women are bitchy. Like, I don't know.
I was like, I like these vibes over here. So became your, and part of what I saw in this shadowing during medical school was a lot of female urology. And so I kind of was already in that like trajectory before I even started residency. And in fact, I considered OB-GYN for the women's health part of things. And then I realized it within urology, like, oh, you can do women's health and be a urologist. And I was like, oh, sold, you know, hook, line, sinker, like I'm sold.
Yeah.
And, you know, the rest is history. So now I do see about like 70% women, maybe 60% women. And then the rest I see penis owners, I should say, 60-70% vulva owners and the rest penis owners. And I like that I can do both.
Yeah.
I like that within like sexual health, I can see both,
the team
sides of whatever. Yeah. I hate to like be so binary because, you know, gender is a construct and all of that stuff.
Yeah.
But I like
that. But I don't see penis owners. So like sometimes the patients come in and they're like, well, can you help me? I was like, well, I probably know what he needs, but I'm not going to.
But I'm, yes. Yeah. Like
I'm not going to. Yeah. But I can tell you who can. Dr. Min.
Down the street. Exactly. Yep.
Yeah.
So yeah, I get to do like vulva vaginal reconstruction. I get to do men and women's sexual health. I get to do incontinence. Yeah. I get to do hormones for men and women. That's the bulk. And I even do some like cosmetic stuff, like cosmetic gyne and cosmetic penis stuff. I like actually one of the most common procedures that I do in my office are penis fillers. I do those more than I do.
We might want to do a little intro into those. I mean, because I have all types that listen. And even even some of my vulva owners are like, well, I need some help with my, you know, they always need help with their, if they're heterosexual, they need help with their partners. Because women are carrying the bulk of that, I think, you know, in terms of getting their partners to where they need to go.
Yes.
Now, that's really cool. And I actually love how outspoken you are, like, when it comes to like just owning who you are, you know, the because I when I sometimes I read some of your posts about people who write bullshit like responses to you, and I'm like, what is wrong with these people? I mean, what kind of America are we living in right now? It's a whole different.
Oh,
topic.
Like, and I repost their stuff, and yeah.
And you're like, oh,
I expose them.
You just said to me, oh, you wouldn't come to me because I'm black or something, yeah, whatever it was.
I mean, if you talk crazy to me, I'm going to expose you. Not so because I want people to like attack them, but because I'm like, you realize you're talking on this public page and you're, saying something really offensive. Like, let me just share it with the world, you know?
Right. Well, and people don't even realize that as women of color in this profession, the kind of stuff that we hear, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it's very shocking sometimes when I tell when I tell other colleagues that are not women of color. I'm like, well, you don't even know. Like, sometimes, you know, people don't want to see you because X, Y, or Z, or, you know, they say offensive things to you. So,
yes.
I always say, like, medical bias works in both ways, right? Like, we can prevent bias to our patients, but we also need to be protected as clinicians, too. So.
Absolutely. Their medical racism isn't just the discrimination that patients get, but it's discrimination that the people within medicine get, that we get from our colleagues, we get from other staff member, we get from patients. I mean, one of the craziest things a patient told me was like, slavery wasn't all bad. Like, a patient who I was actually taking care of had the gulls to tell me this. Like, and you know, like, I'm like, you need me. I don't need you.
Yeah,
and
exactly. What is wrong with you? It's so funny. She must have been from, they must have been from the South, because, you know, I grew up in the South, and you never learn why the Civil War happened. It was just about states' rights. And
it's
that's
like
what I learned
rights.
Forever.
Yeah. I grew up in the South,
I read,
too.
Like, Malcolm X's book, and I was like, it wasn't about states' rights.
Yeah, let's be real. Exactly.
But that's why you get brainwashed back there, you know?
Yes.
So it's like,
yep.
Symptom. Anyway, well, we have to keep speaking up when we can, and I appreciate that you do for all people, which is great. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the cool stuff that you get to do. You know, one of the issues that women often complain about, especially, you know, in midlife and beyond, and we talk a lot about hormones on this platform, but really when you start having this bulge in your vagina, right? Like, you feel something, you're doing some jumping jacks, you can't have a bowel movement without pushing down on your vagina. Mm-hmm. Like, all of these things that are from, you know, your pelvic floor issues that develop. So can we talk a little bit about the different types of vaginal reconstruction you do for these herniations that happen in the vagina, whether or not it's the herniation of the bladder into the vagina or the herniation of the rectum into the vagina, and how this impacts people's quality of life?
Yeah. So I see something called pelvic organ prolapse, and it is basically a hernia through your vagina where things are coming out of the vagina that should not be coming out. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times patients will come and say, I felt or saw something, and they immediately kind of freak out. They think the worst. They're like, oh my God, I'm like going to die, or this is cancer or tumors growing or something, you know? And fortunately, it's rarely it's almost never an emergency type of thing, but it can certainly affect normal bladder and bowel function. It can affect sexual function. I'll talk about that shortly. And if nothing else, it just doesn't make you feel like a woman. You know what I'm saying? I get a lot of like, I just don't feel like a woman anymore. I feel like something is really wrong with me. I feel a lot of shame. Women with pelvic organ prolapse tend to feel more shame and like be self, have poor self-image. And that plays a lot into their sexual dysfunction.
Right.
And they may hide it from their partners for a very long time. They may hide it in ways like they just don't, they kind of close off intimacy. They may decide to just retreat into their own selves. And so even though it's not technically life-threatening, it can really affect multiple aspects of a person's well-being. Studies show that like depression is higher in people who suffer with pelvic floor issues like prolapse. I love treating pelvic organ prolapse. It's a fun procedure to do because you see the fruits of your labor right away. A lot of what we do in surgery or in medicine, you have to wait to see the like to see, you know, the improvement. Okay, come back and let me see how things go in 6 weeks, yeah. 3 months, whatever. You don't get to see like the immediate effects. But like with pelvic organ prolapse surgery, I get to see the patient walks in with a broken vagina, if you will, and then they leave the operating room with me having reconstructed and put it back together.
Love it. Yeah.
Patients tend to immediately, you know, feel the difference, you know, and be like, oh my God, I felt like a ball was hanging between my vagina, or I felt like I'd grown a scrotum and now I'm leaving the hospital. Yeah, these are verbatim
terms they say, though,
that have said to me, like, I've had a patient who's like, I feel like I've grown a scrotum.
Yeah.
A really common thing people say is, I feel like a tampon is in that's not quite up. Like, if you've ever worn a tampon and it's not quite in the right place, or if it's like a tampon that has been in there way too long and now it's like starting to descend, you know, you feel this, you have an awareness of something between your legs. That's a common way people have described it, like an egg between them. I've had some people like basically had to change how they walk and move because it's so much prolapse. It's like completely prolapsed out. And it can, as you know, can like excoriate. Things can excoriate and things can bleed and it can get in the way of like peeing and pooping, as I was alluding to, where people have to push in to kind of get the flow started, or push in to like evacuate their bowels. That's called splinting. Yeah. And it's a telltale sign of prolapse or pelvic organ prolapse. If you feel like you have to like push into your vagina, like get things going.
Right.
Worst cases of pelvic organ prolapse I've seen is where patients couldn't urinate at all. It was so out that it was blocking their channel, their urethra. Mm-hmm. And so they were in retention of urine. They could not urinate. Yeah. And where we had to put a catheter in, I've seen it so bad where the retention led to kidney failure.
Yeah.
And that's like, you know, really rare. Mm-hmm. But when that happens, obviously something has to be done.
Right.
And so most of what I do is surgical repair for prolapse, although there is non-surgical like pessary placement. But a lot of patients, by the time they get to me, end up choosing prolapse surgery.
Sure.
And I offer all methods of prolapse surgery. I offer both uterine sparing and traditional like hysterectomy and prolapse repair. Uterine sparing is basically like, we don't have to take your uterus.
Yep.
And we can fix your prolapse with keeping your uterus. This is going to be like maybe a diverge, but I feel, and you tell me how you feel about this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I feel like we take too many uteruses out. Mm. For benign reasons.
For benign reasons, yes.
Like, we're like, take it out. I'm like, it doesn't have to come out.
And
just because we're done with the baby making doesn't mean we want to come out. In fact, studies have shown that women, when they're offered options of like keeping their uterus for prolapse, a large portion of women will choose to do that.
Absolutely.
Even though these are mostly like post-reproductive women that definitely are like done with kids or post-menopausal, but they just like don't really want to part with this.
I mean, it's an organ, right? Like, you know, nobody really wants to have like organs removed when they don't. And I think so many women connect with it as part of who they are. It represents something to them, like, you know, their babies' houses if they did.
Yeah.
But there's some connection. Some people have sexual, like really good orgasms from their cervix. And, you know, and so you're going to remove that, even though it's like a big debate in like the OBGYN literature, like should we do super cervical or not, or preserve sexual function? But, you know, there's three nerves that innervate the cervix. And, you know, when people do leaps and they do other things on these services, you know, some orgasms are compromised. And so I feel like we have to take all that into consideration if it's not something that you have to remove for a cancer or, you know, other issue.
I totally agree with you. And I don't know how many prolapse surgeons do this, but I always ask about sexual function and orgasms.
Mm-hmm.
And I have had women tell me that they get cervical orgasms, that they enjoy deep penetration to their cervix. And for those, then the last thing I want to do is take their cervix or shorten their vagina with like a vaginal hysterectomy.
Mm-hmm.
In those patients, we either do a uterine sparing or we do a super cervical so we can keep that cervix keep that vaginal length. But I think there, I know that there are plenty of surgeons who don't even inquire about these things. And then women just have procedures. Now, overwhelmingly, I don't want to poo-poo a hysterectomy. Like, overwhelmingly, studies do show that women who get prolapse surgery have better sexual function afterwards. Like, it tends to improve sexual function no matter what type of surgery they do. And I think that's because sexual function is so impacted by the presence of this bulge. And,
or the feeling of a gaping vagina, right? Like, people are like, oh, her vagina's so
gaping. And and like the body image thing, and then just like the the logistics with maneuvering this like bulge just coming out, that getting that restored no matter how you do it just is a plus, you know. And so I feel good about doing any type of prolapse surgery for you know, as far as like sexual function is most likely going to improve no matter what I do, whether I take the uterus or don't. And then I do both like vaginal and robotic approach. And the times that we do robotic, which is a machine that allows us to see 3D and really go inside the abdomen without doing a big cut. We can use small cuts on the belly, quick recovery. In fact, these patients of mine, they don't even stay overnight in the hospital. Is, you know, when we want to do a more robust repair and potentially use mesh. And when I say mesh, that's when patients like get a little...
Because I hear all the lawyers talking about mesh.
Their eyes are like immediately like... And then I tell them, listen, you all, like, there's not like evil mesh out there. The mesh that we use nowadays and who's doing mesh has greatly, greatly like reduced mesh complications. And by and large, mesh complications were like in the minority in the beginning, in the first place. But the was like the vaginal prolapse mesh kits that were large sheets of mesh, like big as your like hand and palm that we used in the vagina. Those were the most problematic ones if you were going to do one. And now people don't even do those. I mean, they're basically all but off the market. The mesh we're talking about with like robotic repair, and we'll talk about stress incontinence and in leakage in a moment, and we use mesh there. Those are low risk mesh. And even ACOG, the American College of Gynecologists, and SUFU, Society for Urodynamics and Female Urogenital Reconstruction, they have come out in support of like, you know, favor of the low risk mesh that we can offer individuals.
That's great. Yeah, I think that's what you hear about. And we should talk about like TVTs and those kind of things that, you know, used to like, there's a lot of negative press around the complications and around sexual function. So I think that's worth discussing. But
yeah,
I do think that you're totally right. And I even like when it comes to people's sexual function, even if I'm going to do a leap on someone, I ask them, like, do you think that you have cervical orgasms? Do you have vaginal or like, or do you feel like you've, you know, do you have penetrative orgasm? Do you have it only with the clitoris? You have to ask what type they have.
Yeah.
Because those are the people when you don't ask, then they're like, wait, nobody told me this. And now my orgasm's gone. And so I feel like we already like discount women's pleasure so much.
Me too.
Is a medical profession that if we're not asking, then we're just contributing to women not seeking it either. So
when they say, I have a question for you. Like, so if they say, yeah, my, all my orgasms are cervical, like, and you need to do a leap, like, what do you, how do you counsel them? How does that change what you do?
I just say, you know what? I always, I, based on what the category is, it's like CIN 2 or 3. I just tell them that, you know, what my goal is to remove the least amount of tissue with the most robust, like, way. Like, we don't do these honking leaps anymore where we take a huge amount. And I said, you know, I can never give you your tissue back. So if for some reason we have to go back because there's like some precancerous cells that don't get cleared on their own over time, then that's something we can address in 6 months or a year. But I'll just try to take the least amount that I can that will hopefully be curative for you. So I use a very small loop.
Like for me, if they say that for pelvic organ prolapse, like I said, then I'm going to be like, well, we shouldn't, we should avoid the like lap or lap vaginal or vaginal hysterectomies and consider super cervical or non-hysterectomy prolapse. to, you right. know, and I tell them, like, you know, and even the ones that choose, they're like, oh, no, I don't have cervical orgasms, and choose to do hysterectomy, I do always tell them there may be a theoretical risk of, like, changing your sexual function when we do a hysterectomy.
Right.
Fortunately, I haven't really seen patients complain, but as you know, women yeah. may not complain. But I tell yeah. them, like, yeah. we don't know what the numbers really are, but there is a little bit of a foreshortened vagina when we do it. So, you know, that mm-hmm. might be perceived sexually post-operatively and feel different to you sexually than, you know, before a hysterectomy.
Right. No, that's very true. And I think it's, you know, and it's even like, even if you can't avoid some of these things, at least you asked and at least you
prepared.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Prepared them, right? Like that this may Agreed. Or may not happen. Because the worst is when they just come, if they feel like it comes out of nowhere.
Yes.
And then they're just angry that they didn't even know it was a possibility.
Yes. I saw a patient, this is not prolapse, but I saw, to speak to this like anger where the patient's like, well, I didn't know. At least somebody could have told me. I saw a patient, I did not do the surgery. It was a male patient who had a circumcision as an adult. And he had a circumcision with another urologist. And he had a significantly less sensation, gland sensation. And he was he was upset by it. And the circumcision yeah. looked great. Like he healed beautifully and it looked great. His penis functioned normally mm-hmm. and he was getting orgasms, but he was yeah. just upset with the decreased sensation. And I was like, yeah, that's something that it's something that I can't counsel patients on. Like, and he was like, no one,
yeah.
the doctor never told me about this. And I always counsel this is another area where I counsel all my patients that have circumcisions, my male patients. Hey, you might notice changes in sensation. And these changes right. in sensation may make it may be decreased, you know, yeah. after we take this foreskin. So and most people make their best decision and they proceed with it and they knowing that this might be a possibility, but at least they, you know, have heard it.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, and I think that's informed consent, right? That's what we try to do. And so I feel like it's the best way to go for those patients. But sometimes I think patients get overwhelmed with everything you tell them too. So that's why I'm always like, just bring someone in so they know.
The other thing is, did they really not tell you or did you just not remember? Right. That's also possible.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
So, because I know sometimes patients are like, I don't remember this. And I'm like, document everything.
Yes.
So I'm like, no, I wrote it. Okay.
You signed it, actually.
Yes. Remember where we talked about this? Yeah.
That's
yeah.
so funny. Well, let's talk a little bit about incontinence and I'll give you HIPAA permission to talk about my case.
I can bring you up, use you as an example. Yeah.
Yeah, you can. I think I've spoken a little bit about this before, but I do have moderate to severe stress incontinence from after my third child, who I had 6 years ago. And she was small. She was only 6 pounds, but I don't have great collagen.
But it's three. You had three.
Three. That's yeah, that is true. Three.
Yes.
Three. So and I've truthfully been, you know, a little scared to get a sling because mainly because I don't want that kind of downtime.
Okay. So I was about to say, like, what scares you? Like,
it's not the surgery. It's just the downtime afterwards. Like, then I can't do like my normal exercising and all the things that I want to do. You know, it's like a long time to not do it, right? 6 weeks, right? Or is that not true?
All right. Yeah, okay. Y'all. Okay. So she, I'm going to call her out.
She's
being a little, maybe slightly, I don't want to say ridiculous. That's mean it, but. Over dramatic, maybe.
True.
Okay. All right. So Dr. Mann has stress incontinence, which is leakage with activity, cough, laugh, sneeze. I think you remember, I remember you telling me like, oh yeah, if I'm on a trampoline, forget it. Like, I can't enjoy the trampoline with my kids.
Forget it. I can't. That's my test. Because right after the procedure, I was jumping. And I was like, the trampoline test worked.
Which is great.
You're like, I could jump. Yeah.
So there are different options for it, but two of the most common options treatment is a midurethral sling, which is a really good surgical option, considered the gold standard, and it is a slip of mesh, like a hammock, like a tape of mesh that's placed under the urethra through small cuts in the vagina.
Mm-hmm.
And
Do you do TO2s? Do you do transobturator now? Or does anyone still do TVT?
I don't do transobturator. So transobturator is one route. I don't do transobturator because of it potentially has a risk of pelvic pain. And I don't, there's other options that you can do. Like, I really don't see any benefit to doing transobturator when I can do a retropubic or do a single incision sling. So those are my two go-tos. Like, I'll do a single incision mini sling.
Does anyone do TVTs anymore?
Yeah.
Like this, I'm dating myself based on what I did in training. TVTs, TOTs are not done that one?
Okay, so TOT is transobturator. That is still done. It's not that it's not done. It's just...
I always found it barbaric when we did them.
Now you're going to be people are going to be like running away from this. And then TVT is still very much done. TVT is the gold standard. Right. It's what I call retropubic. But it's basically you go behind the pubic bone instead of going through like the thigh, if you will, for the people listening. TVT, what you like did not get trained on because this came after, which has been around, which has been kind of evolved over the last 15, 20 years, is these single incision or mini slings, which are these small pieces of mesh. So it's like a third of the standard mesh that we are used.
Okay.
So it's a small piece of mesh. I tell people to like, it's if you put up your index finger, it's like about the same dimensions of your index finger. So that's how much mesh it is. It's just a small piece. And we go, and it's one cut in the vagina instead of like having multiple cuts. It's one small cut in the vagina that's like an inch or less. Mm-hmm. And it literally takes
me
15 minutes to do. It's like such a short, easy procedure. I love doing them.
Yeah.
And because it's a small piece of mesh, I do like doing that like on my surgery naive people, especially and ones that are mild to moderate stress incontinence. Mm-hmm. I do probably 75-80% of my slings that way. And I have really good success rates. Like majority of my patients come back happy. And they're like, I'm, you know, it's rare that I have a patient who I've did a sling that's like not improved.
Okay. And you make a mid-urethral incision?
Yep. Mid-urethral.
And that's it. And then you just pull it up, just like the TVTs?
And then it just goes, like, I wish you could see it with me in the OR. It's like you get this one trocar and you use it for both sides. Okay. And it just stops at the inner fascia obturator.
Oh, so you don't bring it up like you used to the TVTs?
Yeah. No. Yeah. And it just stops right there and that's it. And then you just close that one incision in the vagina you're done. I mean, you do a cystoscopy, but, and then you're done. I don't prescribe pain medicines for it. Patients feel like themselves within a week, although the restrictions are still 6 weeks. So this is the part that Dr. Rahman is like, not like scared of, but she's not willing to commit to is the better term. And it's the 6 weeks where.
Yes, I'm not willing to commit. Yeah, it's not like I'm scared of it. It's like, I don't want to not be able to.
You don't have the time. You don't want to commit. Yeah. Get it. I get it. 6 weeks of no exercise, for sure. Nothing in the vagina.
That's not an issue for me. But
it might be an issue for the other doctor. It might be an issue for your hubbins. Okay.
But I'm like, that's not being able to run or lift or those kind of things. Well, you know, for a while it was like my baby was still small and I was lifting her a lot. But now she's...
Now she's not that small anymore.
When I first met you, I think she was 3, and I was like, I'm still lifting her a lot.
She was like 4, 3 or 4. Now what? She's 7?
She's 6.
7, 8. Yeah. 6. Okay, 6. Yeah. So now you don't get to pick her up like that. But yeah, so anyway, it is, you know, 6 weeks of some fair downtime. I mean, although you could work, you could go back to work and seeing patients, I would say, within a week even. And so that is like the most common procedure that is done. But a very common procedure that is done too, kind of probably second to it, is something called urethral bulking, which requires really no downtime, and that's because we're not
That's
making, That's what you did. Yeah, which is why people do it. People do it because of that. And it works by volumizing like the urethra mucosa, if you will. So like the inner lining, the tube that we pee out of, if we plump it up, then the lumen or the canal that we pee out of is tighter. Okay. It's tighter and then we have less opportunity for leakage. So it's a really quick in and out procedure. It takes like 10, 15 minutes to do. We can even sometimes do it awake. I think we did yours under sedation, but we do it awake too. And you go, you know, both of these procedures, you would go home that day. But with this bulking, basically within a day or two, you can do whatever you want. Exercise.
You can bulk with different agents.
You can bulk with different agents, but by and large, Bulkamed, and I do not like get paid by them, you know, like I'm not a spokesperson or anything. But by and large, Bulkamed has emerged as the leader in urethra bulking.
Because people were doing the other bulking too, right? There was a, a different bulking that was done before.
The other agents, like collagen was used, very popular. Was it Durasphere was used? There was, Microplastique. The thing about some of these is they migrated.
Oh, okay.
So we don't, and Bulkamed, there's been no reported migration with Bulkamed.
Oh, so you're saying with the other ones, they migrated and caused complications.
You could see migration, potential risk of migration. Correct. Yep. Yep. And Bulkamed has a pretty good efficacy. And so I don't know anybody that doesn't, that does bulking, that doesn't primarily or exclusively use Bulkamed.
That's the way to go now.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is what we did for you.
And it worked for a while. It just stopped working. It
worked for a while. It's not going to work forever. And I tell everybody that. I told you that. This is not like you ride into the sunset.
I was like, maybe, I know they got, 6 months or something like that.
Really?
I got, 6 months or something.
But, yeah, that was a little short.
Maybe it was a little, it might have been longer. I can't remember, but I just know like at some point when I was running one day, I was like, oh, I smell like
damn it, it's back.
I knew it wasn't going to work forever. So I just, you know, it was to temporize until I could.
Just let me put a sling in you.
Tell myself.
Okay. Okay, let me help you.
Okay. I'll be a better post-op patient.
Oh, yeah, you were a terrible post-op patient. Like, y'all, she was terrible. She missed all her appointments. You missed all your appointments.
I would hate to operate on myself.
Yeah, she missed all her appointments. And I'm like, no wonder it came back 6-8 months later.
Yeah,
like,
that's you true. Anyway. Once I do it, I'm going to do it right next time.
And you went into retention, which is a known risk.
Yeah.
But you were like in retention for a lot longer than usual.
That hurts, man. No wonder people love urologists when they relieve their
blood. I know, when you can't pee.
Yeah.
Oh, my hurts. God. And when that urologist puts that catheter in you and you're like, oh, yes.
God bless. Yeah. No kidding. Yeah. Yes. So that's good. Well, we have some good stuff then. And I'm going to, that's what I'll do.
That is like my favorite surgery to do. Those procedures are also my favorite because, again, it's one of those things that majority of the time when I see patients back, they're like, oh my God, I'm so happy. Thank you.
Yeah.
Like I get so many
thank yous.
It was
a nice feeling for a long time. I'm not going to lie. It felt
good. Yes. Yes. Yeah.
But it's also, you know, when you're so busy in life, like, you know, some people can't focus on, then my mom died. I had all those things happen. And then, you know, so it was.
Understandable.
You know, everything goes on the back burner. So.
It does. We do that to ourselves too, you know, a lot. Like we,
as women, for sure.
We as women put a lot of our stuff on the back burner. You know what I'm saying?
I tell my patients not to do it all the time.
I know you tell your patients, but here you are doing exactly that.
But now I'm starting to. I mean, like I got my mammogram done recently. Like I'm trying to
get that. Good. What was how late were you? Like for your mammogram?
At least 18. I was 18 months, so it wasn't bad.
18 months. Okay, that's not bad.
Yeah.
I recently saw my primary doctor, who was a woman, and she was like, yeah, I haven't gotten a colonoscopy. She was like, 5 years overdue. And I'm like, oh my God, like take the time off and get your colonoscopy. Yeah.
That's so funny.
So we doctors make terrible patients in general.
Yes. It's true. Anyway, that's really good. I'm glad that you're able to tell us all of that because I feel like some people don't know that some of these things are common but not normal, and they don't have to live with them, and they don't have to, you know, have the shame of smelling like pee. I remember I told you when my baby was younger, and they're always like, oh, who smells like pee, mama or the baby?
I know your kids made fun of you. I remember you telling me this. Yes, you know, you have a problem
I have a
when
problem.
The kiddos.
yeah So that's it, guys. That's it. I'm saying it right now. I'm going to do it sometime in the next year.
Yes.
I had to put it out there so that I can, like, you know, when you put it into existence.
Say it, then you're being held accountable because now people are going to listen and they're going to ask you in real life.
Yes. Also, did you get your slang back, girl?
Yes. And then we'll do a follow up.
Yeah.
We'll do a follow up. Yeah.
And I'll jump in, up and down and I'll be like, pee free.
Oh, that'll be funny. That'll be great.
That's funny. Anyway, thank you, Fanua, for being here today. What do you have to say to people that are having a hard time finding the right person? This is what I always ask people. You know, like, I feel like that's the biggest issue, right? Is trying to find the right clinician that'll listen to you, especially as women and women of color, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, first of all, like, go with your gut. Like, if you are seeing somebody that doesn't, you don't feel like you're being heard, you're feeling very unsure, don't, you have choices, hopefully. And please seek second or third opinions. In fact, any physician, a good physician, a sign of a good physician is one who's not offended by you doing that.
Right.
Like, I tell patients, I don't want you to do anything. I don't want you to let me treat you if you don't feel comfortable with me.
Yeah.
And I certainly recommend and encourage you to get other opinions. You know, that doesn't intimidate me whatsoever.
Yeah.
Nor should it intimidate any other good doctor, right? It's, you know, more heads are better than one. Resources for you. You know, you can go on society websites, and like some of these society websites will have like physician finders. So for instance, both of us are part of a society called ISHWISH, International Study for the Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health.
Mm-hmm.
ISSWSH.org.
Uh-huh.
And they have a physician finder.
What is the urologic?
SUFU. And then there's SUFU, Society for Urodynamics and Female Urogenital Reconstruction, although that acronym has changed so many times, so maybe it's changed again. But basically, Society for Female Urologists.
Yeah, OGS throughout. Yeah. Is OGS the same as SUFU, or are they different?
Well, OGS is like the gynae version of SUFU. Yes, American Urogynecology Society, I think, is the what the acronym stands for, AUGS, OGS, or SUFU, SUFU.
Right.
So SUFU.org. You can find, I believe they have a physician locator as well.
Okay.
And or you can, you know, these are like the best places to start off with. If you're in Chicago area,
for these
if you're in the surrounding states, I'm happy to see you and be your female urologist / urogynecologist. I have a practice in Chicago called Down There Urology.
We're going to put all your info in the notes.
Yep, I'm accepting new patients. And I do a lot of pelvic organ prolapse and stress incontinence and incontinence in general in women. And I do treat incontinence in men too.
And you have a partner too, right, that treats?
I do. I have a partner named Jugan Kansal, Dr. Kansal, who is a men's health specialist, does a lot of male infertility, a lot of erectile dysfunction, a lot of testosterone, low T, a lot of that sort of stuff.
Do you do semen? I don't know what I was going to ask you. Do you do semen analysis in your office? Does he have a?
We don't do it in our office, but we send people to get semen analysis done. Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't know if there was an andrology, because I think one of the andrology labs closed downtown.
Yeah, yeah. It's easy to do, though. Yeah. There's a, again, full disclosure, I'm not a spokesperson for this company, but we use a company called Fellow.
Oh, okay.
And they do at-home semen analysis. Like, we trust them.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's a very trustworthy, in the urology community, it's a very trustworthy lab. Uh-huh. And they'll send the patient a kit, and then the patient jizzes in that kit, sends it off. And they will do a full semen analysis. They'll even do cryopreservation. So they'll even do sperm banking.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I have a lot of patients with sperm banking because I have a lot of young men that have low T.
Yeah.
And I always encourage them to do a semen analysis and sperm bank before we start.
Oh, smart.
Low T, because when we give testosterone, it will decrease sperm production or cease, make it go away, actually, completely.
Yeah.
And, sperm banking through Fellow is not expensive. It's like $150 or less per year.
Oh, that's really good, actually.
It's cheap.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's good to know, because I have a lot of patients whose, you know, spouses are like, I need to get mine checked. And
Thanks. Tell them to do a semen analysis at meetfellow.com. They can order it. They don't even need a doctor's order or anything like that.
Oh, very good.
Fellow. Mm-hmm.
Awesome. All right. That's a good piece of learn something new every day. So,
yes.
Anyway, well, thank you for your time and your fun and for being my urologist.
I'm here at your service, ready to sling you.
Thanks, guys, for joining me for another episode of Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. I'm Dr. Samina Ramon, Gyno Girl. Remember, I'm here to educate so you can advocate for yourself. I'll see you next time.
If you have a second, please subscribe to this podcast. I'd love for you to be a follower and learn as much as you can about the things that we're going to talk about with all the people on our journey. Please review us on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. These reviews really help. Review us, comment, tell me what else you want to hear. To get more information, my practice website is www.cgcchicago.com. My website for Gyno Girl is www.gynogirltv.com. My Instagram is Gyno Girl, so please follow me for some good content. Additionally, I have a YouTube channel, Gyno Girl TV, where I love to talk about all these things on YouTube. And please subscribe to my newsletter, Gyno Girl News, which will be available on my website. I will see you next time.